Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and I have Kim and Nathan Ellis here.
Hi. Hello.
And it's a delight to have them. Their film, Delivery, was at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival in 2019, and I am proud to say it is a member of the Discover Indie Film TV series. In fact, it's in Season 3, Episode 6, which came out last November, I think, or October, and it took me this long to get them in here. My bad, but they're here. We're going to talk about Delivery and find out what's behind their careers and what got them to this point. And that is actually how I always start off. But I want to say, like, Delivery, I watched it again to prepare to talk to you guys because, gee, Sherman Oaks 2019 was the last festival before COVID.
That really was. Oh, my gosh.
It's like 10 years ago, it feels.
Seriously, when was that again?
It was before the world ended,
Yeah, it was literally, 2 weeks before Thanksgiving. And then after Thanksgiving, we started hearing about it and everything shut down.
Yeah.
So it's actually a very special festival in my mind because in a way, you were part of the last one. And you both were really enthusiastic and showed up there for the festival. I always love filmmakers who actually... go to film?
I actually went to a lot of the screenings because I really liked that festival because it was like bite size quality films that had good Q&As afterwards that weren't too long. So it was like I don't know how long it ran. It was like an hour or a couple hours a night or a few hours a night, but it wasn't that bad. And you didn't feel like drained at the end of it.
That's the other thing. Yeah. We go from 6 PM to midnight.
Yeah.
So that staff doesn't burn out. Cause like when you go to noon to 12 kills everybody,
but it went quickly though. It's like you sat through several sessions and it felt quick because I think it was well organized and the films were all good. At least I thought so.
They are all, no, we have really high standards.
Yeah.
And you reminded me you were in the Kick-Ass short film block, which had all those films that kicked ass. I mean, there was I can't name all of them, but there was yours. There was the one shot in China, to show off. Oh, The Teacher. The Teacher.
Yes, I remember that.
$1 million budget, I think.
That was the $1 million short that looked like $7 million, right?
Yeah.
Because that was the Chinese government built a mini Hollywood and just wanted this guy to show off what they can do.
Yeah.
That was trippy.
Yeah.
But your film also kicked ass.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And I just want to compliment you. I just want to say how good it is. But take turns, but tell me your stories, how you became actors and filmmakers and everything, because it's such a well-made film and it's so polished. And when I watch it, it's so cinematic and so well-directed and well-written. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious what path you took.
Ladies first.
Oh, okay. Well... I actually don't have an acting background. I was a teacher and a school counselor. And I got into acting just maybe like four and a half years ago. So I'm still kind of new. And Sherman Oaks Festival is actually it's my first festival, right? Yeah.
It was one of the first.
Yeah. But anyways, and so how I got into acting, it's long story short, I just took an acting class. First week I was hooked. I'm like, oh no, like, is this my calling? And, you know, I had a hard time like admitting to myself. It took me about a month to admit to him, excuse me. And then it took me about a whole year to admit to my family. And then the rest is history. I'm like, okay.
Family's way harder than...
Oh, especially like my family. They're just very traditional, conservative Asians. And I was terrified of telling them actually at the time. But that's how I got into acting.
Yeah.
And Nate, did you already have like the directing ambitions before she mentioned she was into acting? It should have been pretty easy to tell the director I want to act.
Yeah, this filmmaking has been something I've done since I was a little kid. I knew this was something I always wanted to do, but I was in the military first. It was a decision I made in middle school. I wanted to fly helicopters in the Army and do that stuff, so I did that. I did that for 7 years after college. And then while I was leading up to that point, and even in the military, I was making stuff on my own just when I had time. And then when I got out, I was at USC for grad school, which was great because it was 3 years of incubated, protected, don't have to worry about a job, making movies, decompressing from the military. And then I met Kim after, at the very end of my time at USC. And delivery was something that, it was our first project we've done together. And people would say, you know, did that ruin your marriage working with your wife? And it didn't. It actually was, it's just like.
It worked really well together.
It worked really well, yeah. And so I encouraged her to do acting when she expressed, when she took the classes at UCLA, and she had that passion that I understand from what I have for writing and directing and stuff. I said, do it. Don't worry about what your family thinks. Do what your heart tells you to do. And, you know, and ever since it's been a wild and productive and fun ride.
Just because it's unique, I want to ask about when you were an aviator and you were doing film stuff on the side.
Yeah.
Like, what was that like? What were you just grabbing handycams or?
So the military, they, like when I was deployed in Afghanistan for a year, my commander said, Nate, I'd like you to do some media for the unit when we return, because he knew that that's one of the things that I love to do. And so on top of everything else I had to do, it was sort of a fun burden, because it was like, okay, now I have to officially do this thing that my commander very vaguely asked me to do. And what I did was I ended up making an interactive DVD. Throughout the course of the year of our deployment, I would have time here and there to catch snippets of footage and do interviews with people. And at the end, we had this DVD. We made 1,500 copies, gave it to every soldier. And what it was you open the DVD and you're back in the base. And you can click and walk around the base. And when you click on certain things at the base, it would go into a video, like a 2-minute video mini doc of a certain company or a certain group. And so people, in fact, last week, people were asking me, do you still have that DVD? I want another copy, which I don't, unfortunately. But that's how I was able to do it.
Right. So that's even more intensive than just like writing a couple stories and like grabbing guys within a free hour and shooting. Like that sounds pretty intensive.
Yeah. I'm glad that footage is some of the most personal footage to me, because it takes me, whenever I watch it, it takes me back to, you know, I was 10 years ago. I was 27 years old flying in Afghanistan and just seeing some of it. I mean, that's cherished footage. I mean, that's footage that you can't get. It's real. Even though none of it's combat footage, for obvious reasons, you're not filming while you're flying, but like...
That would have been a bad idea.
I'm glad I have that, and I have it preserved on this special drive that I always know where it is, and I know, you know, I'll never lose it. It'll never get corrupt, because, you know, it's special, and it gets more special as I get older. And I look back at it, and I'm like, wow.
Again, I'm glad I asked, because that's very cool.
Yeah.
And then you came out of that and did undergrad film school or graduate film school?
So it was graduate film school. Post 9/11 GI Bill paid for most of it. So I knew that I wanted to go to grad school for film after the Army. I knew after my 7-year commitment as a pilot, I'd be about 29. I was like, it'll work out just fine. And let me tell you, I got way more out of the Army than I ever imagined I would before I went in the Army. Because before you go in, you're thinking you're going to fly and do these things. But when you get out, you have all so much more life experience, mainly with people and issues and things like that. So I went to grad school on the Army's dime, mostly 3 months after I got out of the Army. So I got out of the Army May 2013, started grad school in the fall. And yeah.
Awesome. And you just started making films.
Yep. It was 3 years. I focused on writing and directing. Really just having fun, like being a civilian again. And like I said, Kim got the tail end of that. That's when I met her.
I was going to say the obvious question would be, when did you guys meet?
Yeah, we met in 2015.
Yeah.
It was like a few months before you graduated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we met on Match.com.
Match.com.
Legit. Yeah. That's legit. Yeah.
It was weird because I was not interested. I was married in the Army. I was married very young, and it just didn't work out. No regrets. So I was not looking to get married again anytime soon. I was young. I was, enjoying LA, and then I had this weird pull to get on Match.com, and she was the first person that reached out to me on Match, and we went on a date. And now we've been married happily for, 5 years?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was still a school counselor at the time. I lived in Bakersfield.
Yeah.
And I was a middle school counselor. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to have a hard time finding single guys out here. I don't know. It's just in my town, at least. And so I was like, I'm going to join Match. I tried the Tinder and everything. I'm like, oh, that's too raunchy for me. So, and I wasn't looking to get married either. I'm just, I just wanted to meet a decent guy and have fun. And he popped up on my profile and... Yeah.
Right? And when you start having fun, I will say this as someone who... I think your second marriage is always the best. What can I say? Yeah. I was married before myself. And, and I, when I ended up single, I had like the best, I shouldn't say this, but I had the best 6 months of my life. And then unfortunately I fell in love and I've been happy ever since. Right. But it's funny when you're like, I'm just having a good time. And that's when you find the right person.
Yes. Yeah. So it was like after a combat deployment and a divorce at 27, I was like I was starting a new life, and it was glorious.
Absolutely.
I came back. I was alive. I had all my limbs. I had all this perspective. And in a way, I realized that this sounds bad, but I was free. Like, I can do whatever I want. The future is unwritten. And so it was this glorious time.
And you two met right before you graduated?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then you were released. Then you just started your lives together.
Exactly, yeah.
As mm-hmm. artists
right.
and a couple.
Mm-hmm. What's great is that we're in it together. So it's like all the uncertainty that comes with this kind of career, we understand each other and we're right there beside each other all the way. And in fact, she's made me a better director and producer because I've really learned a lot about acting.
He helps with all my auditions. And yeah.
And I feel like she's learned a whole lot about writing and what mm-hmm. goes into getting a movie made and all that. So it's like people say we're like a power couple, but it's just great because we have something to talk about all the time.
That is great.
Yeah.
That is great. And power couple or not.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's so complimentary too.
Right.
So was Delivery the first one you worked on together?
Yeah.
But had you done other shorts and stuff besides school?
Yeah. Well, mostly in school and then stuff. I've been doing this stuff since I was a kid, so I had all kinds of little things. But Delivery was the first thing. We looked at each other and said, let's do something as legitimately as we can.
Something meaningful.
Something meaningful and something that we can both have fun doing.
Yes.
And so the idea of, a former human sex slave taking vengeance.
Turned assassin.
Awesome. Was kick-ass. So.
She was trafficked, and now she is going to stop them.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it was the introduction to a much larger character that there's a feature script for. But what was fun about the short was the guy that you think you're rooting for in the beginning ends up being the guy that you want to die, and the person that's the person you're scared of ends up being the hero. And that's was our thought was we're introducing this sort of anti-hero in a cool way.
Absolutely. Although I think I remember saying at the Q&A, and I even say it now, like your lead actor, Steve Vanderzee.
Yeah.
Like, he's so charismatic.
Yeah.
I'm still always sorry that he gets it.
Yeah.
Like... Because it's his first day, and maybe he doesn't know. Right. Maybe he thinks it's just heaps of heroin. I don't know. Maybe, it could be like garbage bags full of heroin back there. It doesn't necessarily have to be. I think it's a woman or a daughter.
It's actually my sister-in-law and her niece. But yeah. They're not actors, and they killed it, I think.
That's interesting. Yeah, I saw the name Ellis. Yeah. A couple different first names with Ellis.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
Yeah. Steve's great, by the way.
Oh, he's so sweet.
So he was our roommate at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're like, hey, let's just make a film with all our roommates.
A house full of artists. Let's do something together. And
that's very cool. And that's a very, look, that's a very Norma LA thing in a way.
Yeah, it is.
That's it's in a good way. Yeah. In a good way. Yeah, actually, I think, okay, so as I watched the credits, I did actually write this down. So Nate, you did the writing and directing and then editing. And then you have the song Shot in the Dark written and performed by Nate Ellis. And that's the song at the end, right?
It's the song when it's the song playing on the truck radio when Steve's character arrives at the site of the scene of the action there. And so our sound editor, who is a talented musician, very talented musician, Samuel Shoemaker, he was actually having some issues writing a song on the spot. It's like, well, we need some country song here. And so, my composer just did the creepy, carousel type beat that I was like, just do some sort of a creepy country carousel type beat. And then I just wrote some lyrics and it ended up just sort of flowing. And so that's
very cool.
Singing too.
Yeah.
I didn't, that's wild. That's very cool. Yeah.
And I'm not a singer. So I was just, that was one of those moments where I got to just bite the bullet and do it.
I think you were sipping on whiskey and recording.
Yeah, I think I got a little drunk. Just
legit. Not to mention that, I mean, also when you're making a film and you're, everything you do, you don't have to pay someone else to do, right?
Right. Well, that's why the film itself was a skeleton crew, $4,000 budget, which was the budget that it was the smallest budget we knew we could make the film that we wanted to make with. Obviously more money would allow for more, but $4,000, 2-night shoot, and some favors and some smaller payments to people that generally wanted to do it.
And I gotta say, it doesn't look like you needed more money. It looks just like it should.
Yeah.
You know, there's no point, you know, and the shots are all great, and your cinematographer did a great job for you.
Yeah. Wes Rodriguez, he's my guy.
Yeah. And so there's no, where would you have, whatever, you threw out a number. You know, if someone threw an extra $3,000 at you, like, sure, you could have used it.
Yeah.
But you didn't have to have it. Like, you absolutely did a great job.
It might have bought us another day. So 2 days was 60 setups total. I mean, it was packed. And so we had to have a very efficient, we had to have a very efficient, like, we went, we knew what we were doing, and we had to sort of stay with
it. And both were overnight shoots.
Overnights, yeah.
Yeah, you had to start after sundown.
Yeah. Mm. So that was a little, I mean, that's always a little rough because your sleep cycle's thrown off.
Yeah. Poor Steve. I remember him just crawling around in the dirt constantly doing this scene.
By the way, not just wife, but when your female lead or whatever, your lead murderer or no. angel of avenging angel.
Yes,
when the avenging angel has empathy for you instead of being like, God, you're making me work too hard. Yeah. Like, that's a nice thing.
Yeah.
Well, it's always fun being on set. I love being on set, that, that creative environment and working with like-minded people and everyone's busting their asses, and it's just...
How great is it? Yeah, you're all out there in the middle of the night and it's hard work, but you're all there and everyone more or less is loving it. That's awesome. I mean, not to be dramatic, but when you're like, when I was in Afghanistan, some of those times you're like, I just want to go and live my life and do what I want to do when I get home. I just want to go after everything I want to do. And so, fast forward a few years, you're in Santa Paula at 3 a.m. with your wife looking like a friggin' murderer. You're like, this is, and everyone's having a good time, even though it's work. It's like, this is it. This is awesome.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I'll add, based upon the group of people who were involved in your film, who were at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival that year, everyone enjoyed it. Everyone had a good positive time, whether it was overnight or not, because you had a good team show up.
Yeah. It was, Ian McClellan was also a former roommate, but also a classmate at USC. He actually produced my thesis film at USC. Doug Yablin, our editor, also someone he's actually Wes's, our DP's roommate. And so we worked on stuff together. Doug actually won that Project Greenlight contest a while back. Not the show, but like the film contest. And
so the one where people submitted samples of their directing?
Yeah, we had to make a short film, and he did his – actually, I'm pretty sure it won. I remember it won some award for it. And so we've all been making movies for years together. And so when the time comes and you're like, okay, you know, we're really going to take a stab at something here, and it's going to be two overnights, and you're not going to get paid much, or if not at all, but we'll feed you well, and we'll give you rides or whatever it is, you call on those few people that you believe will – want to do that and trust you. So that's the thing, is like, I don't want to waste anyone's time. When you're doing something like that, I'm not going to drag you out in the middle of the night for 2 days and not pay you, but feed you well and waste your time. You're going to, my commitment to you is to make it efficient, make it worthwhile, and make it something that everyone goes, this isn't just Nate's passion project. This is something we're all making together, and it's going to be great. And so that was the vibe. And yeah, it turned out to be a good time. We had some, you know, a truck got stuck in the mud, and you know, there was a quinceañera blasting music right when we were trying to shoot at the park next door.
Yeah, well, you actually, a lot of people avoid having a production vehicle at all, right? Having a vehicle on camera is a risk.
Yeah. That van. So that was Ian's crappy van that his dad gave him, and we weren't sure that thing was going to make it to Santa Paula, and you know it gets horrible gas mileage. So of course I was paying some of the budget went to the gas for the van, but yeah, that road was very narrow, and so you had to really think ahead. Like, okay, we're going to get these vehicles on here. We got to get this one first, turn him around, but first you got to get the camera up there. So it's like this logistic thing that 90% of the work for the film was done before the film was shot, which is normal. But like, you really had to think about that stuff because, yeah.
You have to think it through because you can't throw money at the problems. You have to throw your brain at it.
Exactly. So yeah. I PA'd on a big movie once, and one thing I noticed is a lot of money was thrown at problems. And that was the big difference for me. Watching that compared to what we're doing here, which was, you can't do that. You got to really give it the TLC it needs.
And by the way, that old GMC truck feels like a character, man. When it gets shot and it comes to it, it almost like it's yet another character that dies on screen.
Yeah. I think Ian has a name for it. I don't remember what it's called. It's been a while.
And I believe Kim, I remember from the Q&A, you got, gun training lessons for this film, yeah?
I did, yes. Oh my, so that thing, super heavy. And I remember, like, I got a really good workout, just constantly prepped, rehearsing before the scenes, and then that night, like, just even, like, making it look natural, you know? Oh my gosh. Yeah. And then that thing is as tall as me. I'm, like, 5'3", and so, yeah.
The trick was not, she had to look like she was commanding the weapon, right, and not the weapon commanding her. So in the beginning, because it was so heavy and so and such, it was almost as tall as she was. Mm-hmm. She was putting her whole body into shouldering it, mm-hmm. and so we had to work on making it look like using momentum and little tricks of like throwing it to make it look like it was easy to get against her shoulder.
Yeah, I mean, did you start in on this kind of thing like at the script stage? Like you knew you were going to play this part.
We did start early, yeah. As soon as the script was done, we're like, all right, we went to the prop store. That was fun.
Yeah.
Picked them out, came home, and that night we just went right into it.
Yeah.
And then we did it for a few days. We didn't want to overdo it because, again, you know, it was just too much work on my shoulders. And so, it was fun, though, looking back.
And I remember we were on set, and Kim was in character. And we have our family. We have, you know, my sister.
Oh, yeah. There.
And they're like, what's wrong with Kim? Like, no, is she mad? She's upset? Like, no.
Trying to maintain that character. Intensity.
Like, just leave. Because they're not film people. So they're like, they were just genuinely concerned when Kim was sitting quietly in the front seat of the van.
Between takes and like, you know, and I'm trying to like conserve energy too. Like it's, you know.
But you were being a little method-ish.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah.
It was cold. And so a lot of my energy went to like trying not to shiver. Especially in front of the camera. Yeah. Trying to look badass.
And I have to ask, tons of spoilers, right? But who chose the mask?
So, you remember that story?
The mask?
Originally, it was going to be a ski mask.
Oh, that's right. We even tried it out. I think we have pictures.
We have old pictures of her in a ski mask. And then we went to the prop store, and they had the ballistic mask, which is the one we picked. But I saw them, and I'm like, wait a minute. That thing's awesome looking.
We tried it on. We're like, this one's it.
Yeah. So it was a happy accident. But that goes along with the feeling of when you have an interest to do something, you don't necessarily have to know how it's going to come together. You just have to get it going, and then the doors, things like that will happen. Mm-hmm. So that mask sort of just happened to us.
And that mask is heavy, too. Yeah. Oh, and they made me half blind. I don't know if you noticed.
Oh, yeah, no, the one eye was...
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so that completely blocked my vision.
Oh, so you can see through that contact.
So I literally was half blind. And not literally, but
depth perception, right?
No, yeah. And with the heavy mask and the heavy gun, and it's freezing cold, and it's just, all right, let's do this.
So you make it, Kim, turn left about 45 degrees so you can face who you're talking, because she couldn't see, or she's like, okay, where is he?
I had a hard time like turning over here? My neck, so it was just like this, turning my whole body. Like.
And I noticed, and it's good filmmaking. Good editing, but I noticed when she went to remove the mask, there was like, I was like looking, I'm like, is she going to have to unlatch all this stuff? Like, was that a cheat? Did you just like have her hand go up and then it was already?
Yeah, because we have to take, you have to like unsnap the thing and then take the ski. Because
like with it on, like she almost has a predator vibe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was the thing too, is we decided her character would never run. Her character was confident and knew that she had the upper hand. So, like, sort of like Predator or like Jason, she's always walking and in control. And that's more scary than if she was running around like a ninja in the dark, you know? Yeah.
And we try to keep her dialogue to, like, the bare minimum as well. Like, we'd be like, no, she probably won't be talking too much.
And as an actor, you are embracing that character that, don't give me too much dialogue.
Yeah, which is rare.
And it is rare.
Saying, don't give me lines. You're like, okay.
Yeah.
That was actually a lot of that was her doing, her character being just one word type of thing, which I think was great.
Mm-hmm. And then we decided that that she speaks Spanish, and so I had to take very basic Spanish lessons with his sister is married to a Mexican, and so
excellent. And in the feature, obviously the character is more prominent.
Yeah, the feature isn't the main character, but it's the, at first you think, this is a spoiler, at first you think it's the antagonist, that it's but it turns out to be, you think it's the friend of the FBI agent protagonist who faked her death to take on this vigilante mission. But it actually, at the end of the movie, turns out to be the main character herself who is living this sort of like Fight Club. It's this alter ego. She was shot in the head and all this stuff too, so it makes more sense that she would be that delusional. But so in a way, you think it's the antagonist, but it turns out to be the protagonist and the antagonist are the same person at the end of the film.
I don't think that's going to spoil anything.
Yeah. Hey. I don't think it's just a script, so who knows if it'll ever get made. But
Are you tempted to... I mean, you did... did you do delivery as a proof of concept?
We did originally because, when you're doing something, your passion is super high about it. And I still am passionate about it, as is Kim. But it's taken a back burner to other projects. So it is still there. And I would love to make it one day, but it's not on the priority right now.
Right. And it probably, I imagine you wrote even more action throughout, which makes it way harder to pull off by indie standards.
Well, yeah, it would be probably, I'm guessing like a $12 million budget to do it right with the way it's written now. but
which you can't do that on, you know, every other weekend.
No. No, the favors would get raunchy at that point. You couldn't make.
Well,
that.
I gotta assume there's like vehicles exploding and turning over, and I mean, you know, her character alone has got to have some more firepower than that.
Yeah, it's It seems when you think, you know, you trick yourself when you're writing it. Oh, you could do this for less. But you know, the more you learn about filmmaking, the more you realize, no, this is an expensive movie. If you want to make it, you got to make it take place in one room with two people. And that's just not, this movie can't live in that world. So
absolutely. Although, as we learned at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival that year, you can go over to China, I guess, and get seven times your money, you know.
Yeah.
You can turn 2 million into 12, apparently.
Yeah, there you go.
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I never approached that guy who did the teacher about doing this podcast because I was like, I realized he's just kind of doing a commercial for some city in China.
Yeah. Exactly.
Now, yeah, talk about inside baseball, like we're talking about a film that we watched together almost 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Well, so the other things you have coming up, more stuff that you're writing for Kim. Do you guys ever throw out the idea of writing a script together?
We have, actually.
We have. We've come up with, like, story, like the concept together, but he does all the writing. I'm not too much of a writer right now. I just want to focus on acting. Maybe one day, who knows? But, so there's this one project. I don't know, do you want to talk about it?
Yeah,
American born.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there was, so I'm not from here. I was born in Korea. I grew up in Australia. And then I came here about like 7-8 years ago for grad school. You know, I thought I wanted to be a school counselor. Anyways, and so I was researching, the history of like Asian Americans in here. And so I found out about this lady named Susan Uncutty. And she was the first female Asian American to join the Navy during World War II. And I was just like, oh, this is fascinating. Like, you know, there should be something about her. And she has like websites and stuff, but a lot of people actually didn't know about her. And I looked at him like, this would make a great movie. And, you know, he calls it the light bulb, right? The lightning bulb.
Mm-hmm. Lightning bolt struck.
Yep. And it, was like, okay. And so he started writing at the end of 2015. And now it's, you know, it's with a production company and, you know, they're hoping to make it next year, quarter one.
With a studio. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a legit thing now that we started off, it took place in a classroom. And, you know, the intent was that Kim was going to play.
Right. So we were thinking, oh, it would be an indie movie. And, you know, and we were just sitting around in our underwear talking about the story and this and that. And then, and then it just kind of grew and grew.
Yeah,
and
now it's. Yeah.
And he was going to direct as well. And so in a way, like the project kind of outgrew both of us. And so
in a good way.
Yes.
Like I have. So we have Ashlyn Ching Yi is a half Chinese Canadian female director, great director. She's attached. Southpaw is the production company, and they usually partner with studios for distribution. We have Greta Lee, who's she was on The Morning Show and Russian Doll. She's an amazing actress, and she's the lead, and now we're packaging it to move forward. And so this has been this thing that we worked on it together, and it's grown into something that we both feel really mm-hmm. proud of.
Mm-hmm.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, so.
And we just feel like there hasn't been a story like this in Hollywood yet.
It really hasn't.
Yeah.
And so, thankfully, they're open to it now.
Exactly.
Well, that's the thing is, like, I have like 8 scripts, and this one, you never know which one's going to go. You have an idea, oh, I think this one should go. But then the system, this one launched, like, skyrocketed. And I think it's because of the paradigm shift happening, and that's a good thing, I think. And this particular film, we think is.
Well, just,
there hasn't been one quite like this one.
Right, and just socially, especially these days with all this stuff going on, I think it's very relevant and.
Yeah.
And now I must tease. So I asked, you know, about your backgrounds. And Kim, you completely skipped being born in Korea and growing up in Australia and then coming to California. That's a pretty, do you want to elaborate? Because that's not the run-of-the-mill story. you know, I was born in the 60s, so I grew up in a very, very Korean community.
Oh.
A lot of Koreans, because of the Korean War, people got to move in. So I've known Koreans all my life, and no one came via Australia.
Oh.
I mean, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Yes. So I was born in Busan, which is like a southern city in Korea. When I was five, my father and his new wife, they decided to immigrate to Australia. I think everyone at the time, this was in the 80s, everyone was going to coming here, basically. And I guess he wanted to do something different. And so I was like, okay, let's go to Australia. And then I spent most of my childhood there. I had the accent back in the day, believe it or not.
Like 5 to end of high school?
Yeah, like I didn't finish high school. I actually went back to Korea during high school, and I had to finish off my senior year of high school there, which was a huge culture shock because I didn't speak Korean at the time. I had forgotten all of my Korean. And they had a corporal punishment back then, and so I got beat up a lot. Little things like, you know, in Australia when the teachers telling you off, they're like, look at me when I'm talking to you. In Korea, if you look at the teacher in the eye when they're like telling you off, that's a sign of disrespect. And so I didn't know that. So, you know, they're just like shouting at me in Korean, blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like looking up at them like this. They're like, what are you looking at?
Damn.
So I went to college there, and then, you know, I was kind of lost, you know, my 20s, and I was like, okay, you know, I'll be a teacher. I love kids. I'm good with kids. I didn't necessarily have a deep, burning passion for teaching, but I was like, you know, I need to make money.
And you were bilingual.
Yes, and that helped, yeah. And so became a teacher. I did that for 5 years. And then during that time, I knew I had to get the hell out of Korea. So like, okay, enough. I want to experience something different. And so I did think about going back to Australia, but I'm like, you know, I want to try again. Maybe it was my dad in me, but I wanted to try something completely different where I didn't know anyone. And so I decided to come here. And so I went to grad school in San Diego. And then a job popped up in Bakersfield. And, you know, I had never been in a place like Bakersfield. I've always been like a big city girl, you know, living in Seoul and Sydney. And so I'm like, okay, let's try out Bakersfield. And so I went there, and it was great. I mean, it was a really good experience. The people there, people that I met, they're so genuine. But it was hard being a middle school counselor. You know, I thought I would be good at it because, you know, I'm very emotional and empathetic and all that. But it was just, I would take home the kids' problems, and I felt just like the weight of their problems just weighing, you know.
Some pretty serious problems.
Yeah.
In cases.
You hear some really messed up stuff in the counselor's office.
Yeah, well, Bakersfield can be rough.
It's
rural community and poverty issues.
I think I was calling CPS every week. It was just a regular thing, yeah.
That's heavy.
Oh, gosh. And so did that, and then it was during the summer I decided to take an acting class. So I was still living in Bakersfield, but I was with him at the time. And I'm like, you know, let's do this. And then, yeah, like I mentioned earlier, I was hooked. I don't think I would have started acting without him, without his encouragement.
Makes sense, but I was going to say, it seems like a recurring theme with actors that they have moved around a bit as in their youth and had to adapt to different cultures and things, because that is acting, right? When you
Exactly.
She's got a lot to draw from. I mean, that was the Cliff Notes version, but she's had like a very rich and varied experience, especially as a kid, which would make a movie in and of itself, I think. But like even little things like her American accent, that she did that because when she was teaching the kids in Korea with an Aussie accent, they couldn't understand her. So she had to learn an American accent.
I purposely changed my accent. And it helped that I was surrounded by, you know, American teachers and Korean Americans. And so it was easy to latch on to that, you know.
It's not just neat. I mean, if you had told me you were born in L.A., no doubt yes. I would believe you 1,000,000,000%. So you can walk into a casting, into an audition, and just whip out an Australian accent when you need it?
You know, it's
as if anyone ever asks.
It's kind of like faded over the years, you know, but it comes and goes, especially when I drink. but yeah, no, this accent has now stuck, and I think it's not American, and it's not definitely not Australian, so I like to call it my international accent.
It feels American to me. I mean, like you said, I think if you told me you're from LA, I'd be like, yep.
Mm-hmm. I've been told that I don't have an accent. It's just very, like, standard.
I think that's what we're talking about. Yeah. I had an Australian guy here yesterday, and he... whipped out his American accent. But we were discussing accents, and I was saying the thing is, because of Hollywood, the LA, no one calls it an LA accent because Hollywood has made it international English.
Yeah.
You know, there's a Brooklyn accent, a Texas accent, you know, a Midwest, a Wisconsin, this, that, and the other. But if you sound like you're from LA, no one calls that an LA accent. Yeah. Unless it's like Valley Girl or whatever, you know, or Surfer Dude. But you know what I mean? So so you have a perfect international entertainment industry,
awesome.
Which is actually, I think this, I think it's the California accent or LA.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And your Australian did not need to be dusted off much. It was on point too.
Thank you.
You should see her drunk. It's
I'd love to. I'll mention something else when we stop recording. That's quite funny. But
I can do a really good Korean accent too. But we'll get into that.
Which
later.
You know, we're huge fans of Kim's Convenience in this house, and whenever we see those actors interviewed, and they sound like they spent half their life in L.A., and you're like, oh my god, they're you know, just funny.
Yeah.
All right, well, I'm glad we got that from you, because it had been skipped over.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very not surprising at all that you had an actor inside.
Yeah.
Because when you were in Australia, you were adapting to that culture, and when you went back to Korea, you were adapting
there,
and then you came
true.
Here.
And looking back, I think I always felt stuck between, like, the Western culture and then the Korean culture, and so I feel like I was acting a lot growing up, you know. I was a certain way with my family, mm-hmm. and then completely different with, like, my friends and at school. And so, yeah, in a way, I've been acting. Well, I think everyone acts, you know. They're in certain situations and with certain people.
Yeah, but living in another culture, I think you have to have a different level of it.
Right, yeah.
Especially
and so, definitely, like, I was drawn to Western culture more because that's where I felt like I could really just sit back and be myself. With Korean culture, I'm more like very proper and like, ah, 네, 안녕하세요. 아, 네. You know, just very proper.
Well, it's very tough on women, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely, yeah. So a lot of restrictions and rules.
Just strong cultural expectations.
Yeah.
So anything that deviates from that plan... is people, you got not just your family, but you've got the whole culture questioning what you're doing wrong. It's not even seen as different or unique. It's just, like, wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And acting is definitely something that is way out in that field, in that culture.
Mm-hmm.
She actually didn't tell her mom she was acting for a while.
For a whole year, yeah. Like I said earlier, I just didn't want to deal with all that. And I was still, I think I had a hard time accepting it myself in a way, because I had never considered acting at all, ever. I mean, I was in the drama class in high school. I loved it and all, but to really dive into it, and I've never pursued my passions before like this. And so it was just a huge step, like, coming out of my shell.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's another cultural thing, is not pursuing your passion.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you just have to go for that job that makes a lot of money. Yeah.
One of my best friends I grew up with, he, Korean guy, grew up in L.A., went to college, became a CPA. Two years into his first job, he was driving in L.A. and saw one of those billboards that said anyone can apply to the police academy. And it was someone of every nationality, men and women. And he realized, I want to be a cop. And he did it.
Yeah.
And you can imagine how his parents felt about the CPA quitting accountant, being an accountant, to become a policeman.
Yeah.
Oh, didn't. It was rough. I'm glad his parents would never hear this.
You never know.
I'm glad my family will never hear this.
Right, yeah. Don't let them.
They won't understand anyways.
That's cool. Well, not to put pressure on you, but I think Nate should totally write a script where you get to play multiple characters, whether it's Peter Sellers style or... split personality, whatever.
We have discussed an idea about like a school counselor. You know, that's my thing. That's my background. And she's very different from what you would imagine a typical school counselor to be. So, you know, she might be like smoking and, you know.
She confiscates a joint.
And telling the kids like, yeah, you can swear in here. Fuck it. You know, but I don't know if I'm allowed to swear on that.
You are allowed to swear. That's okay. We have the explicit thing checked on our, just in case.
That's good to know.
And I guess I should get used to telling people that in advance, but I just assume.
Yeah. Mm. We're all adults.
That's right. All right. Well, anything else you want to throw in?
She's got her first feature as a lead coming out soon.
Oh.
Oh, congrats.
Yes, I'm very happy about it.
It's in Korean?
It's in Korean and English, but mostly in Korean.
The director's
Korean American. It's about mental health. I'm a huge advocate for mental health. And delivery actually stems from like my personal experiences in dealing with like mental health and all that. I'm very excited for the film to come out.
That's excellent. Yeah. That's excellent. Do we know where to look for it or not quite?
It hasn't come out yet officially, and so we're still waiting on more details right now.
It's called Dawning, right?
Dawning,
and Young Min Kim is the writer director. Mm-hmm. I think it's gonna do the festival thing. So you never know. We should tell Young Min to submit it to the Chevy Oaks Film Festival.
No reason not to.
Yeah.
All right, well, you just queued me up to talk about the festival, so I guess I'll jump into the closing statements. Kim and Nathan Ellis, thank you both for coming in. I call you Nate most of the time, but I have it written down here that you're Nathan in the credits, right?
Nathan in the credits, but Nate or Nathan's fine. Whatever you're feeling.
Well, these two made Delivery, which you can see in Discover Indie Film, the TV series. Go to Amazon Prime Video. Go to Season 3, Episode 6. We have your film, and then it's followed up by Worthy, which another two great dramas that go together perfectly. I have in my notes, I wanted to tell you, I love the fact that it says a Punk Riot production.
Yeah, that was Ian's production company at the time.
So it's not yours?
No.
Well, let him know I like Punk Riot.
I will. Right.
Well, so I mentioned the Discover Indie Film TV series. Just go to Amazon Prime Video for it. And by the way, give it 5 stars. I never remember to ask people. Give it 5 stars. And if you want to learn more about the podcast, go to discoverindiefilm.com or go to social media. It's at DIFWINS. And the Sherman Oaks Film Festival that we were talking about, that's every November. Go to shermanoaksff.com. And on social media, it's at shermanoaksff. And there's a sister festival. Finally, this is the last thing I have to mention. Film Invasion LA happens every June. And you can learn about that at filminvasionla.com. And on social media, it's at Film Invasion LA. Thank you both for coming in.
Thanks for having us. It was fun.
And thank you, everyone, for listening.